weigh in, you know, and how does, is there something there that we can all learn? I think is something that I like to.
And you got some thoughts on.
I do.
What Ghanem
said. I do.
This is Bob Brown, and I'm interviewing former Lieutenant Governor Carl Oves today. Carl was involved in an incident in 1996 near Jordan, Montana, involving the Freemen, which were an extremist group that attempted to form their own country, I guess, essentially. And Lieutenant Governor Oves was instrumental in working out a resolution to that conflict. And he's going to tell us that story today.
Well, thank you, Bob. And I've had the opportunity to share parts of it. I'll try to share it all in one story here together. Well, it was March of 1996, as I remember, near the end of March, and I was sitting here in the kitchen one evening, and I got a phone call. And there was a strange voice on the other side, and it said, this is such and such from the FBI. Do you know anything about what's going on in Jordan? And, of course, I just barely heard anything, and I said, no, I know nothing. Well, as the conversation went on, it came clear that my name had clearly came up in relation to what was going on as the Freeman affair. What had happened, the FBI had arrested two of the principals, Leroy Schweitzer and a guy named Peterson, in a sting operation to bring down this Freeman operation that had moved from first round up and now we're in Garfield County near Brousette. They were doing some funny things with checks and money and the Treasury Department and of course the worrisome of just having a militant group like that out there bought the rest of the two principals. When that happened, the rest of the neighbors around there, who some were truly Freemen, some were more sympathizers and some were just scared, all retreated to what they called the ranch, the Clark Ranch, and it became known as this, and it became a standoff, which lasted for 81 days. Well, of course, I had no idea why I wouldn't get a call from the FBI, but come to find out at the time, there was a guy that was one of my best friends, still is, was working for me. His daughter had went off to school in Helena, married a young man who was an airplane mechanic, and he was a Stanton. And Stantons, of course, were neighbors, and actually his dad was one of the original Freemen, and they'd gone up to the farm to help try to keep the farm, and when the standoff began, they were in the compound with the rest of them. And the FBI, in this attempt to avoid a Ruby Ridge and Waco incident like we'd seen before, decided that the tactical team wasn't necessarily going to be the lead, that the negotiating team would have more influence on decisions made than tactical. And so they were looking for what they called TPI, third-party intermediaries. That would be family members, somebody that knew somebody inside that they could try to start to crack things up before it got totally out of hand. And my name had came up with some other legislators who are that's, I guess you would say, on more of the conservative side, and I was, you know, befuddled why I wasn't necessarily known as one of those kind. But it was obviously because of this young lady that I knew very well. She was like a second daughter to me, and obviously she had given the name out of somebody that they thought they could talk to. So Butch, their dad, and I thought, yeah, we're going to run up and see her anyway. Let's go run up there and we'll talk to her for a few days, a few hours, see if we can't get her out and come on home. Little did we know. So we jumped in his pickup and drove to Billings, and thinking, well, we'll, you know, the FBI wanted to meet us in Billings. They said, you meet us in Billings before, you know, you go in. And we went to the Sheraton Hotel and saw an awful lot of people around, way more than I thought there should be. Come to find out, they were most all of them were FBI agents. Not only were, you know, they were checking us out to make sure that we were, I think, capable of even going in there. So we drove on up that next day and drove on into the compound and to see Val and to see his daughter. And you know, as I remember, it was not too unlike driving in a lot of ranches in the middle of the afternoon. There was a few little more activity. There was people carrying guns, you know, around, but you know, it wasn't something that just stuck out to me as totally. It was a little nerve-wracking, you know. It wasn't just totally non, ordinary, but it was more so than you would imagine. It was kind of like driving in the yard, and here's a bunch of people around. But then after we started conversations, it became very clear that these people were truly there was trouble. They were truly agitated, and there was, you know, they wanted some, there was something was, you know, have to change, or there was something going to happen. Luckily, I was able to bring out the FBI before we went in, you know, asked us, you know, took, set us down for a 2 or 3 hour interview to see what we could bring out. And luckily, I was able to bring out a list of demands that they wanted, which was the first time they'd ever seen anything like that in the first couple of days. A list of 10 demands that they wanted.
This was the result of your first trip into
first
their
compound? First trip. Actually, it was probably the second trip. I think we went in the first night and then came back in the second night, so it was probably the second trip.
Now, Carl, these people who were in there wanted to talk to someone of authority. The idea is you were a state representative at the time, and they felt they needed to talk to some kind of an elected official.
Yeah.
And so that's which you got over to Billings, and the FBI worked with you a little bit and were satisfied that you could maybe help them with this. So you went in and got brought back these 10 demands, which was really the first time any important communication had taken place.
That's correct. They did. They wanted somebody with a title, and I was a freshman legislator. I had a pretty good title. But nonetheless, I think I had some other qualifications that built that, started to build a trust relationship. I was raised in eastern Montana. I was a farm boy. Edwin Clark and I were about the same age. We could, you know, when things got tough, we'd always talk about horses and cows and sheep.
And Edwin Clark was the fella whose ranch
That's right.
these guys had made into
their compound. That's
yeah.
correct. And so we had some other things that we could relate to, but
you didn't know him before this incident, but you had a similar enough background that you connected with him.
That's
well.
Correct. And I was a legislator. And the one thing that one of the 10 things they demanded was they wanted this so-called grand jury. Well, you know, first that doesn't sound bad, but their idea of a grand jury was quite a lot different than your and my idea of a grand jury, you know. And so as a legislator, I thought, well, maybe we can figure out some sort of thing that will satisfy them just to get this thing cooled off a little bit, that, you know, that'll say. So I talked to John Mercer a few times on the phone. I said, we'll need some, you know, we'll need some more people in here. And so we went through and found 3 more legislators, 2 Democrats and 2 Republicans. Dick Knox, your uncle, being one of them, and John Johnson from Glendive being another one, and myself, Joe Colisi from Butte. And so they agreed to come up and meet with them. And so that was really the first.
So they went into the compound with you and met with
on these on about this was
yeah.
about a week later, yes.
Yeah.
And we, but it was the first time that we'd started actually some communication going. And I would go in, you know, every 4 or 5 days. Anytime there was a new initiative, they would send me in to introduce whoever was coming in, whether it would be these legislators was the first, and then
yeah.
John Connor, the attorney from just from Department of Justice, various ones, even down.
Did John go in with you?
Yes,
too?
Oh yes, even all down to Bo Greitz.
Oh yeah, well-known.
So you know, all everybody in between it was. I was kind of the person that would be the introduction person, just because we had this kind of relationship.
And they regarded themselves as a separate political entity, so they regarded these things as actual negotiations between the what they call themselves the Justice Township. Justice Township, and they were the officials of the Justice Township, and so it was a sort of one government negotiating with another is how they viewed it. Right?
I would say that's pretty accurate. You know, not everybody. Some of them believe that more than others. You know, some of them were more crooks looking for a hideout, and some truly, you know, were believers.
I don't want to take you where you get you off your narrative here, but I'm curious to know, and maybe this will come out, who the principal characters were. You've mentioned Edwin Clark, and how they came to be in this location, formed the Justice Town.
Well, you know, it was interesting for me. I told you that. Sometimes through this whole thing, I thought everything I've ever learned in my life is for this moment. At the time, or just prior to this, I was I worked for the Montana Department of Agriculture as a peer counselor for people who were having trouble with financing during the 80s. Remember the farm crisis of the 80s? And so I had a little experience working with people who had financial trouble. And really, this, in a lot of ways, was an offshoot of some of that. The Clarks had made some bad decisions, I think, business decisions in the 80s, like many of us did, but were unwilling to admit it. And of course, we all like to blame somebody, so it's easy to blame a bank or a nameless, faceless government for all your troubles, and then you're not responsible for anything. You know, they're responsible for all your faults. So they kind of went down that path, and in many ways, it was similar to you know, the crisis of the 80s, and that's what started it. But the difference is they took a turn, and at their rage and at their anger and at their feeling of injustice, they took the path of least resistance. And in walked a guy with very charismatic, very smart, says, "I have all your answers." His name was Leroy Schweitzer. And he said, I can fix this. All you have to do is not pay your taxes, and I got a way to show you how to do it. And I'll even hold classes." And they had classes, and they had a classroom, and they had people come from all over Montana to take these classes on how to avoid this stuff. And that's what really had gotten.
So Edwin Clark had been foreclosed on.
Oh, yes. And, you know, there's...
And so this was his way of keeping the ranch.
That's really
right. Followed
this
advice.
And his family, his dad, yeah. too. His dad and his uncle, both, they were all in that same position. There's one other little side to this story that probably needs to get mentioned, is that in Garfield County, a lot of people are related. And some of the elected officials were related, and it was kind of an old family feud that had been going on for years and years and years. And there was a little agitation there that, you know, was real or imagined, I don't know. But mm-hmm. there was certainly some family issues going on at the same time that created this just terrible rage in these folks. That, you know, just, you know, I remember standing out there with the legislators talking to Edwin, and he was so full of emotion, he couldn't talk. He'd just cry about this whole affair of losing, how unjust everything was.
Because one of his neighbors was going to end up with his ranch?
Oh,
and he resented that deeply, or
oh, I think it's
some relative,
I think,
or something.
Yeah, I think it just goes back to family issues. I think, but nonetheless, you know, I mean, we all, anybody who's had financial trouble, you know, faces things. They were really vulnerable to a guy by Leroy Schweitzer. He was the stimulus that created the, you know, and so. That's kind of how it started. And then they were in Jordan, I mean, in Roundup, and they'd moved to Jordan to the Clark Ranch, and that's where this whole thing took off.
Did you understand, I mean, what was the concept that this guy that Schweitzer peddled to Clark? It was a...
Well, I spent hours and hours, and they would, you know, the Universal Commercial Code, the Bible, I mean, they have about the Constitution, I mean, they did about... six documents that they just fly through, you know, and try to prove to you that this was, and you know, admit it, and I'd listen, but it meant nothing to me.
But that somehow,
and then if you added enough Latin to it, you had to be right.
Okay, sure. And so they made the case to these desperate people that the government didn't have the legitimate authority to foreclose on their ranch. That was really the bottom line.
And then eventually they got carried. The government didn't have legitimate to do anything to you. I mean, you could separate yourself from the country. I mean, it went so far as that you had the right to do whatever you wanted to. I mean, it went beyond even the ranch.
So that's the three men thing.
And that's where everybody else started coming in. Because originally it was kind of a farm thing. And then all these other characters started showing up because, you know, this movement was kind of around the country. And this was pretty exciting. So these Russell Landers and all these people, Dale Jacoby, they all started showing up because this was what they wanted. We got some people ready to fight, and we're ready to secede from the Union.
So they, when this got into the news, they ended up, several of these folks that didn't have any connection with Edwin Clark and the foreclosure and that sort of thing, ended up driving up to Jordan and coming into Justice Township.
I'm not even sure if it was... You know, how the word got spread, but they I think even before they moved to Jordan, they were moving to Montana, some of those.
Okay. And can you tell a little bit about Landers and Jacoby?
I don't
know.
What
you know about them?
There was three
characters. There was some woman who was kind of a mysterious character involved in this, too, wasn't there?
You know, there was characters. Dale Jacoby was from Canada. He was, a former police officer and, you know, a very angry man. Russell Landers, South Carolina, I never knew the man very well, just pretty much just a troublemaker, loudmouth, in my opinion. That's my opinion. And then there was a guy by the name of Rodney Skirdall, who was probably the most feared just because of his size and the way he looked, but because he was a Marine, and he had been a Marine, he'd been a lot of things, but he was a big man, and people were really afraid of him. He'd walk into a public office, people were really afraid of him, but... Later I'll tell a story where he was, you know, he wasn't quite as scary as you might think he was. But so there was a number of characters, and I think that's an important point to make. You know, people would like to say freemen, and like we all do, that means out of control people. But it's like anything else. Each individual had a reason that they were there. Most of them were different, and they'd come together, this group of people had come together because they felt something injustice had been done, and they wanted to blame somebody. It's, like I said, it's easy to blame a nameless, faceless government, and all you needed was that stimulus, somebody to have the charisma and the smarts to say, follow me, I'll show you how to a different way to do it. And that's kind of the scenario.
So when you went in and you met these people, you negotiated with the people you just mentioned, did you negotiate with them on an equal basis? Did they all seem to be equally in charge?
Well, certainly there was a power vacuum there because the principal had been arrested. Leroy Schweitzer and a guy named Daryl Peterson, I believe. And the principal said, so there was really a power vacuum. And that was part of the trick, and it was one of the first things that the FBI asked if we could do, is try to figure out kind of who was becoming the leader, because that was crucial in getting this thing solved peaceably, is who do we have to deal with? And there was certainly a power vacuum in there, and it was a struggle, I think, through most of the time that I went in and out of there, was trying to, that leadership and who was going to be the leader. The new leader, now that the main one was gone, so that was always, it was Edwin's place. It was his ranch. He would have been the natural leader, but Edwin was not really militant in mind enough, you know, for some of those in there. So there was always this kind of struggle, and we did a lot of little things to see if we couldn't figure out. I'll tell you a little funny one. When we first went in there, the first couple of times, everybody in there smoked cigarettes. And smoked a lot, and after a while, cigarettes became kind of there weren't many around. So one of the tricks that one of the FBI agents came up with is, well, let's bring in two packs of cigarettes. You throw one down on the table, and you light a cigarette, and then pass them around and see. Let's see if we can figure out how this works. See if we can figure out who's taking leadership over. You know, little tricks.
Who's taking control of the cigarettes?
Yeah. Well. It didn't work, but I thought, you know, I think a better idea. Let's just land and set cigarettes end to end right out the gate, and they'll just follow us right out the gate. But there was always little things we were trying to do to figure out where the leadership was. And it wasn't until the very end that Edwin finally said, you know, I'm taking leadership, and I'm leaving. My family isn't going to die here. And finally, he just, that was it, at the end of the standoff. That finally happened. So that was always the struggle. But most of the time, mine was just a role of more of a negotiator, trying to get the demands out, but introducing other people who wanted to come in.
And they were all armed?
I guess so. I never really paid that terrible much attention to that. I guess they were armed. It was something that, I've often been asked about it, but it's something that never really overwhelmed me. You know, I never thought that was...
You must have felt somewhat uneasy, though.
There was times, but most of the time, you know, Edwin, you know, there was enough... They were glad to have somebody to talk to, too, and somebody that they could, you know, vent. And I've learned one thing about negotiations. For every hour, or for every time period that you're away, venting is a direct proportionate of it. If I had been gone for a week, I'd have to listen to hours and hours of venting. If I would be gone for days, it wouldn't, you know, venting was... I spend more time just listening to them ramble and vent their anger. And it's a big part of any negotiation, is just being able to sit there and take that. And it was a big part of it. And then finally, after a couple hours of that, you'd be able to sit down and start talking about things that mattered. That first month or so was just pretty much back and forth, kicking in initiatives, keeping contact, trying to, you know, figure out leadership and push leaders ahead, but just maintain contact, introduce new people. We had this team of legislators come in. We were trying to figure out this grand jury thing, and, you know, there was really nothing that we could do within law, and we talked to the governor, and there was nothing that he was comfortable with that would really work, you know, stand, you know.
This was when Roscoe was governor.
Governor, and we were trying to figure out, you know, in my mind, I thought, well, let's just figure out something, and, you know, there was really nothing we could do. So that kind of went by the wayside, this whole...
When you say grand jury, these guys had in mind that there'd be some kind of a jury that would determine their innocence or guilt.
Oh, I don't know if I can
before
remember.
Any charges were filed against
them?
Yeah,
they'll always have this thing called the grand jury. Another big term was redress for grievances, but this grand jury was of peers. So when they say peers, it's people who believe the same philosophy they did.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, and then that then you'd be able to, you know, be acquitted of whatever there was. The other thing that they did was, their idea was that every elected official needed to have a bond on them. And that if your elected official were bonded and you didn't do right as your elected official, people would put liens on your bond. Well, you got enough liens on your bond and you couldn't be elected official anymore. And they did that, and that's where some of those stories about putting liens on people and mm-hmm. all that stuff came about, because that was their idea of how it should be run. So getting that down the story a little bit, you know, this was kind of going on and back and forth. And we really weren't making any really solid progress. I mean, we were probably in day 40 some. I'd made numerous trips. Altogether, I made 19 different trips inside. Finally, you know, there was political pressure building to end this thing. You know, I'm sure from the president on down, you know, this couldn't go on forever, but yet there was this terrible need not to make something like Ruby Ridge or Waco happen again too. So there's a lot of pressure building. As I said before, it was interesting that the negotiating team had the lead role in this case. So I got real close to that crew.
Who were the negotiating team? The FBI people?
The FBI people.
I see. Yeah. And so you'd confer with them carefully.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Before you'd go
in. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, and my tightrope was to maintain the credibility on both sides. Certainly, you know, my oath of office and everything, I protect our Constitution. But on the other hand, if I was going to be in the middle, I had to protect, you know, I had to protect the rights of what these people had to say too. You know, you kind of had to walk that fine line, stay in the middle when even you didn't know where the middle was sometimes, and try to so you could keep the confidence, because as soon as you fell off one side or the other, you know, confidence was going to be gone. So you tried to walk that fine line, letting everybody know exactly where you stood.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very honest with the FBI. I said, I'll work with you. You just be honest with me. You just don't tell me things that aren't going to happen. And I told the same thing to Freeman, just trying to play it down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Just be honest with each other.
You didn't want to indicate to the Freeman something that the FBI wasn't going to.
Well, yeah, you know,
I wanted to make sure that they would. Yeah, when you offered them something that it was real.
And everybody, you know, fulfilled that obligation
yeah.
pretty well. You know, I mean, it was just a matter of trying to stay credible. You know, so you didn't, and it was hard. It was a hard line to walk,
mm-hmm.
especially you know when you knew, you know how do you give the credibility to, you know, all you could do is listen.
Sure.
All you could do is listen to.
Now, just to help us understand here, and I think we pretty much do, Edwin Clark's ranch was a fair-sized ranch, several sections in size.
I suppose.
And the Freemen were holed up in the ranch house and some adjacent buildings.
Correct.
And there was a lane, what, a half a mile long or something?
Right.
That led from where the FBI were and where this ranch house was. And so when you'd say you'd go into the compound, you'd go down that lane. And of course, many of us remember on national news, because this, of course, was a national news story, this mysterious man on horseback that was riding down this muddy lane toward this ranch house off in the distance, and of course that was you, but you weren't, it wasn't known that was you until well into this thing, maybe even after it was over.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was one of those things that kind of got blown out of proportion just
yeah.
a little bit, I suspect. It was getting near the end, and political pressure was building to get this thing ended, and still this power vacuum. And this Russell Landers wanted to be the leader. And of course, we trusted Edwin. Edwin was, you know, had made a bad turn, but he had a good heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were trying to, and all of a sudden, for about 2 weeks, hadn't heard anything from Edwin. Hadn't heard a word, and you know.
You'd been in and out, but you hadn't seen him when
No, I hadn't even been out. I'd been here at the ranch, and I hadn't been back to Jordan for a couple of weeks, and nobody had heard from him. So the FBI called and wanted to know if I'd come down and see if we couldn't find out what had happened, if Edwin was given up or what. So I flew out there, but it started to rain. And it in that country, when it rains, you don't go very far. Well, there was this little piece of no man's land between, you could call it where the FBI was, but mostly was the press, all the satellite trucks, and then the compound and this little draw. And kind of the word was, you know, you want to go down there and get stuck, because then, you know, who gets you out, and what, you know, with all the press there, was just a lot of tension. It wasn't probably a good idea to go down there and get stuck and mess around. So we got back in the car. I said, well, you know, in this country generally, you get on a horse when it gets muddy like this. And so, well, these guys thought, oh, that'd be kind of cool. So went and got a horse from a neighbor, Clinton Phipps, and pretty nice horse. And I got on, you know, and I knew that it was kind of going to kind of be, you know, a little bit bigger deal. I didn't really kind of realize it'd be. And I rode over the hill, and the horse, of course, there's all these satellite trucks. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I guess this probably will be a little bit different than I thought. And so I rode on in, and it was a little nerve-wracking because I hadn't heard from Edwin. I didn't know where he was. If there was any time that I was a little nervous, that would have been the time. And I rode on in, didn't stay very long. Edwin wasn't there. You know, Russell was, and they were very boisterous and kind of strident at that point in the compound. And I'm riding back, and
with no knowledge of what the heck was going on.
Well, I said Edwin was down in a cabin someplace else, and I just remember coming back and said to the FBI agent, I think we're in trouble. I remember that clearly, thinking this isn't going the direction we really want to go. So that was how that started. And you know, the story tells that I rode in every time on a horse. I rode one time when it was muddy. and it was you know, one of those moments that that people like to remember, just because it's Montana, I guess.
I guess.
But from that point on, then I came back home and thought, you know, we're in trouble. And I'd stay daily contact, but only from a distance, because you know, it really wasn't a lot there for me to do. Well, in the meantime, the FBI negotiating team, you know, started conversations, and finally Edwin did shoot.
They were talking to him on the telephone?
Well, they through another party, they started to do a little negotiation. I went back one more time and made another introduction.
But there was another guy going in and out?
Well, it was actually one of the FBI negotiators started a relationship with, I can't remember who now, and was able to talk. But I went back one more time to facilitate that negotiation again. And then went come back home, because it was springtime of the year. I had work to do, and they kept kind of talking, which was good. And every day they talked to me, and I talked to them, and we just visit about it. But I was kind of doing it more from here. And they're very capable hands. They knew exactly what they were doing. And finally, they convinced Edwin showed up, and I was able to talk to him on the phone. And Edwin showed up, and they were able to negotiate a thing that they thought they, because Edwin pretty much finally said, you know, this has got to end sometime. I don't think my family should die.
And his family was there with him.
Well, the kids, some of the kids were, his wife wasn't, but he just felt that it was time, it had gone on long, and the pressure on him was just tremendous. You know, you could just see it every day. Now, not everybody in there wanted that. There was about this time, there was probably still 19 or 20 of them. You know, some of them wanted to, they loved. The first demand they made on me was keep the press away. That was one of the first 10 demands. And by the end of this time, they were loving it. They were out there hanging stuff. They were living it up. They loved to watch themselves on CNN. And so not everybody wanted it. But Edwin, you know, I don't know that he said this for sure. Mm-hmm. But I just assume he said, well, I'm leaving. If you guys want to stay, you stay. You know, I assume that that's kind of where the road he went. And he got a hold of the right people, and it was arranged. So I was sitting in Helena, had just bought a mini storage business at the time, and I get a call from my friends at the FBI. We talk daily. You know, we were going to fly one down. He's going to talk to Leroy. He's in prison in Billings. We're going to fly him down, and if Leroy will give his blessing on this,
Leroy Schweitzer.
We think we've got the deal, and we can, you know, it's not, nobody really wins, but we think we can get this thing without somebody dying. Because there was, you know, they were moving APCs in. They were shutting off power. Things were getting ready to, the pressure was building. They was getting ready to do, you know, some things. And mm-hmm. That probably moved the negotiations along some too.
Mm-hmm.
So they did and flew him down, and Leroy, under the conditions, which I don't recall, there was mm-hmm. some conditions that they...
Did you ever meet him?
Not personally. I talked to him on the phone quite a few times, but never met him.
But you needed his blessing?
They felt that Edwin and his people felt they needed his blessing before they could. We never used the word surrender, because we always use the word come out.
Yeah.
before they could come out, that they wanted his blessing. So they flew him down there, and I get this call from the FBI agent, said, you know, Leroy says that this will work, but we have this one problem, and that's this so-called evidence. And evidence to the Freeman was this room full of file cabinets and boxes and papers and clients and all the things I had that proved that their system of the commercial code, all this system worked, you know, that it just proved that it worked. Well, of course, that was the same evidence that the Justice Department wanted to show, that they were kiting checks and doing all this, you know, stuff that was certainly illegal. I mean, I saw checks that had, you just write a check and put some numbers on it. It didn't matter. It was pretty wild, the things that they'd done with this stuff, and they both wanted the same evidence. They called it their evidence. Well, the Freeman were adamant about it, because they were sure that if the FBI ever got a hold of that evidence, it would be switched and they'd just take the stuff out they wanted. And so they were very paranoid about it. But the FBI guy said, Tom Kennedy said, I think we have it, but we've all agreed that we'll settle it if you'll take the evidence.
But and that's good. I mean, I understand how the evidence, he had to keep all the evidence intact to satisfy both sides before these guys would come out. But do you remember what the agreement was that Schweitzer put his blessing on that made it possible for him to come out?
I really don't. And, you know, it was probably pretty involved, pretty intricate. I really don't. I really don't remember all the specifics. All I remember was that this part of this all of this stuff was an important part of it, to keep it in somebody's hands that both sides felt they could keep, and that would have, you know, it was the linchpin. So I said, yeah, I can run up in the pickup. I was thinking I'd have a couple file cabinets full of stuff, and I'd put them in a storage unit, lock them, and it'd be fine. And before I leave, they called me and said, no, I think we're going to get you a truck, a Ryder truck. So I drive up, or they flew me up, and I go, there's a 24-foot Ryder or 20-foot Ryder truck. And I said, well, this is what we think we're going to have to use. So the next morning, I drove it in, and we backed it up, and we started loading. And we loaded file cabinets, and we loaded guns, and we loaded personal items, and we loaded everything that of value in that truck. It took all pretty much all day, and the truck was just jam packed full of stuff. And it must have been probably mid afternoon by the time we got everything loaded. And I'll never will forget, because Rodney Skirt, all this big red haired guy with bushy hair, big beard, dirty, because he'd been working in the dust all day. And through this whole process, he'd gotten angry at me a few times and put a couple liens on me.
How would he do that?
I mean, oh, I don't know. They never have showed up, so I don't. Maybe they were just threats. Maybe they're just pieces of paper.
Because it'd have to be through the established system outside of Justice Township.
That did happen sometimes.
Yeah,
it didn't happen to me, but it had happened to some elected officials. You know, that, that had happened. So anyway, that end of that morning, he puts his arm on his shoulder. He said, you know, he said, you worked so hard here today. And he said, I'm going to take one of them off of you. And, you know, my reaction was, oh, don't worry about it, Rodney. It's no big deal. Or, gee, thanks. So we loaded it up. And by the time all this stuff's in his truck, I kind of know I'm in trouble, you know, because there was way more stuff here than I understood was going to really be in trouble. But, you know, the good news is this thing was ending and nobody was dying. and there was going to be a happy ending. We'll take this truck, and then we'll just deal with what we have to deal with in the end. And that's where I went with it. And I'll do the best I can to keep my word to everybody I've given to, and the main thing is this thing is going to end. So I drove the truck out, and right behind me came each one of them, kind of in family, and they met the FAA.
On foot,
walked out the gate. And I was in the lead truck, so I had to stand back and look, and watched it on CNN. And it was over. And I wasn't there, but Edwin told the lead negotiator when he got done, he shook his hand, he said, "We had us a hell of a standoff, didn't we?"
And so were they handcuffed and placed in custody and that sort of thing as they got out?
That's correct, and they were taken to Billings, to the detention center. And I probably didn't make a wise decision then. I was tired and hot, and you know, I didn't really feel like driving all the way to Billings that night. And so I made a decision to stay in Jordan that night with the truck. You know, probably not a wise decision in trying to, you know, build confidence on both sides. I think that immediately that Freeman probably thought that I was, you know, not holding my word, because I didn't drive with the caravan on down to Billings.
Or drive with them, because
I just didn't feel like driving it. Oh, a little side note too. How do you take a Ryder truck and seal it? They gave me a bill of sale and a vehicle license number that I had to publish in the paper that I, you know, all the things I had to do, I had to publish in the paper that I had it, and so the newspapers were named, and the vehicle number, and then I took tape and taped every latch and everything that would sign my name on it, taped it, locked it, and took the keys, and anything we could do just to make sure the secure was secure. I still have that document somewhere that gives me the truck. Drove it out, and the next day then drove it to Billings, and I kind of knew this was going to happen, and I just didn't realize, you know, once the truck was full, I realized what position I put myself in. But I, as I said, I thought, well, it's worth the trade-off. You know, we'll deal with it. The main thing is it's over and no tragedy has happened. You know, mm-hmm. The rest of the stuff we can sort out. Well, certainly after I got the truck out, the first thing I got served was from the Justice Department is a search warrant. You know, I had to do their job too. I mean, it was their evidence. And so I had a weekend of, what am I going to do? Do I give this to the Justice Department and uphold my obligation as a legislator, you know, to uphold the Constitution? Do I go to jail and not give it to them? You know, what do I do to maintain my honor?
What commitment did you make to the Freemen?
That I would protect it.
Meaning what? That you'd bring it back here to Harrison and park it in your
And that was never
barn?
Said, that I would protect it. I wouldn't let the, you know, let it be spoiled.
So you felt if you allowed the Justice Department to go through it,
well, you know,
search warrant, that you'd be violating that?
Well, I really didn't, you know, I didn't know that I believed that so much as, you know, is what they believed, and you had to, you know, if you were going to, you kind of had to, you know, honor something that they, you know, you just couldn't take it all away from them.
Yeah.
I just felt, you know, if this was going to be an honorable deal, it had to be an honorable deal on both sides. You know, it was one of those strange moments where you go, you know, now how did you get yourself in this fine mess? But my daughter was playing basketball in Columbia Falls. She was an all-star basketball player, and they flew me up there, and I drove all the way back. I didn't sleep at all that night, that weekend, just trying to think of...
Where was the truck?
It was in Billings.
Parked in Billings?
It was parked in Billings in a secure lot.
I see.
And I had, you know, I had the padlocks, and I had the tape on all the things, and, you know, I mean, I felt secure about that. So Sherry Matucci, who was the U.S. attorney then, a wonderful lady, really, she worked hard to make things work. I went and saw her the next morning, and she said, "I'll tell you one thing, Carl, we'll figure a way out of this. We won't send you to jail." and you know, she was just, you know, making light about it. But so what she and the judge, he was Morgan, by the way, came up with was there was a attorney down in Bitterroot, John Smith, I believe his name is, who had defended some of the Freeman types before that they had kind of been familiar with. And what the judge decided to do was to appoint him as a court-ordered keeper of the evidence, which was probably not totally satisfactory to the Freeman, but nonetheless it was somebody that, it was a step in the right direction. It was somebody that they were familiar with, that they had confidence, he had defended one of their guys one time, and that the court just basically said, we don't care what you think, this is what we're going to do. So it kind of, it was a way to let me off the bad spot, the hard spot that I was in, So I carried out the rest of my obligation of publishing a paper and everything. Then we took that truck to a great big storage unit, and if I remember correctly, we had 5 or 6 copiers, and we copied everything in that truck 4 times. Once, 4 or 5 times, I don't remember exactly. Once for me, once for the Freeman, once for everybody, and everything was copied, so everybody had the original copies, and I or my representative was there to make sure that stuff, so we could honestly say that we kept it together.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess anybody could claim whatever they wanted to, but we tried to keep it as integral as we could. So everything was copied, and that ran for, I don't know, I had to leave finally, but it ran for a week trying to copy all that stuff.
Where is that stuff? Where is you've got a complete set of everything that was in it?
Just about 3 years ago, Jim Sikora called me, and they finally shredded it all.
Who's Jim Sikora?
Oh, he works for the Justice Department.
Justice Department.
Do you know Jim?
Yep. And so the copies that were made for you also were kept by Justice Department?
I decided I didn't need a room full of papers.
Yeah, sure.
That happened 4 or 5 years ago. I don't know, not too many years ago. And they've kept them a long time.
Was there ever any significance of that? I mean, when there was a trial, wasn't there?
There was a trial.
Was any of that stuff actually used as important evidence?
I suspect. I don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't know. A lot of it was not even that important.
Did John Smith defend them in the court? Was he their lawyer?
No, I had court-appointed lawyers.
I see.
So nonetheless, I guess long story short on that whole evidence thing, although it was a very trying moment, it was resolved, and it resolved in a way that wasn't perfect, but it was a way to try to keep it, keep everybody as satisfied as possibly could. And I think, and then of course the next thing was the trial, the trials. And, if there was 18 or 20 people in there was 18 or 20 reasons why they were in there. And there were some that were just crooks. I mean, they were just looking for a place to hide out, and there was some, like the Clark family, that were pretty decent folks that I could relate to, that had just made some really bad decisions and continue to make bad decisions. And so the trial was interesting, and of course they were very, very uncooperative, wouldn't stand, wouldn't, yell and scream and all the things that they...
They wouldn't stand up when the judge would
judge
come
walk
into the
in
chamber,
and they'd be very disruptive, and it was a circus.
We're talking about Jacoby and Landers and those guys?
Yes, that's correct. And then they asked if I would testify on behalf of the prosecution. And I said, I'll testify what I know, but you need to know how I feel about Edwin. I think Edwin had a little more to do with this whole thing.
Having a peaceful ending.
Having a peaceful ending than anything. And Edwin was, I think he thought I'd, He was ticked at me. He thought, I'd probably sold him down the river. And
You'd mishandled the evidence?
Probably, yeah. But he told me one time, he said, "We used you, Carl." And I said, "Yeah, I know." So he kind of understood. That was when he was in jail in Billings. And I went and saw him one time. He said, "We used you." And I said, "Yeah, I know."
So there you are on the witness stand.
I'm the witness stand, when I walk in, it was a very emotional moment for me. When I walk in, Edwin wouldn't stand, wouldn't look at me. And, we'd kind of gone through some times together, and I thought, well, I guess I understand, Edwin, Well, through the questioning and everything, I answered the best I could, all the questions. And one of the final questions was, well, did you ever feel threatened? Did you ever feel your life was threatened was in there? And quite honestly answered, not really, but if I ever did, I always felt Edwin would have been there to take it for me, because that's just how he was. And he started to cry in the courtroom. And when I got up to leave, Edwin stood up. And later that day, he continued to testified in front of the jury, and Edwin was acquitted. Only one of the ones that were acquitted. And, you know, I guess, I don't know if there's any justice in that or not, but it just goes to, I think it just proved my point that he really was a pretty good guy, had just taken a bad turn. And that wasn't, don't get me wrong, not, he was the exception.
He lives?
I'm not sure.
Still in Montana, or do you know?
I'm not sure.
But he no longer has the ranch?
No.
Do you know who has the ranch?
I'm not sure.
What happened to the other guys? Did they all go to jail?
I think everybody else went to jail, some of them for a long, long time. And probably, I'm sure, are still in jail.
Does it concern you that they might get out? Would they have any grievance against you, do you think?
Oh, I suppose there's that possibility. There's several that names that, you know, you don't know. But it's been now, what, a number of years, and I don't think a lot about it. But, you know, there was a time when I would think about it once in a while, but I don't think a lot about it. I think those days are gone, you know, pretty well gone. And I think hopefully they're rehabilitated, and we all understand what took place. I think in some of the older Clark family members have died, and they weren't very healthy at the time. The rest of them, I'm not exactly sure where they all are right now. That's kind of the story of how it started and how it ended in my involvement. And the story that I think needs to be told is and the one that I've tried to tell, because people always want to know the story just for the adventure. But I think there's something here we all need to understand, and that's how I've learned to understand that how people who are good people, who sometimes, unfortunate things happen, and a lot of times financially, and they make bad decisions and go the wrong way. And as I explained before, it's because they let the rage, the anger, the hurt just consume them. And the danger that I see, and the thing that I think we all need to remember is that they only talked to people, and they only associated with people who thought exactly like they did, who would believe exactly the same thing they did, and they just bolster each other with their stories and just feed off each other. Well, as I've gone through life and watched all of us interact, we all kind of do that from time to time. And if there's a danger, if there's something that I've learned, is that always keep your life in balance. You know, don't be afraid to talk to somebody who doesn't agree with you, who doesn't necessarily see the world the same way you do, and it will challenge your thoughts from time to time, and to challenge your way of thinking. Something that these folks were always afraid to do. You just surrounded yourself with more believers, and away you went. Mm-hmm. Pretty much the cult mentality. Mm-hmm. Just fill yourself full of it, and just keep going, and let that rage burn, and not your anger, just continue to go. And so. I always used to give a little, when I talk to kids about it, I always give a little story about balance, about how to keep your life in balance and not get so focused in one area that your life became out of balance, because that's what these folks did, and their what could have been productive lives became just total tragedies because their lives totally got out of balance. Mm-hmm. So I just think there's a lesson for all of us to as you think about dealing with public policy and dealing with people you don't necessarily agree with, you know, just always be able to try to understand at least where the other person comes from, so you can, you know, avoid that. I say, you know, school teachers do it, ranchers, we're notorious where we go down to the coffee shop and complain to each other all the time. You know, it's just kind of who we are. And that's the one lesson I think that I learned is from this whole experience.
Sure, there's a human tendency for birds of a feather to flock together.
That's right.
And for us to sympathize with each other, but when it takes on the cloak of cult behavior, when,
yeah,
as I know, there's a strategy on the part of some of these people who we think of as cult leaders to deliberately isolate the faithful and keep them talking to each other and keep feeding that that idea, that's when things can really get out of hand, and that's exactly what happened in the case of the Justice Township and the Freemen and that sort of thing. Do you know, is there still are there still Freemen? Is there still, do you know if the...
That was a real, the militia and the Freemen was something, big in the, started really in the 70s, probably did in, 80s, 90s. But I,
the Montana Militia movement.
Montana Militia. And I suppose there's still some of that out there. But you certainly, don't hear of it like we did. You know, from my experience, most of that is just a lot of people, puffing themselves up in when it comes to action, oftentimes they're not there. I suppose there's always, in any society, there's always the spectrum and the segments. I'm sure there's still one out there somewhere. We just don't hear as much.
It's a psychology as much as an ideology. Yeah. And so I think that's always there. It's probably just sometimes above the surface and sometimes beneath the surface, but there's always the possibility that frightened, paranoid, desperate people will do some desperate kind of thing.
On either side of the political spectrum.
Sure, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, Carl, you received a significant award from the FBI, I think, didn't you?
I did.
It
was the Lou Peters Award, and it's given by the Association of Retired FBI Agents, and it's their highest award they give to civilians for public service. And I got to fly out to Hawaii to receive it.
In Hawaii,
and receive an honorarium from Louis Free, the director of the FBI, and it was a very honoring moment. And I was very honored. But then when you read some of the other recipients, it was very humbling because most of the recipients of this award have done something much more direct. But it was a very very nice award, and I'm very proud of it.
Well, that's wonderful. Anything you'd like to say in conclusion?
Well, people often ask about it. I guess, in a word, the adventure of a lifetime.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.